So, Miles, I've been thinking about alternate universes.
That is pretty reasonable, Jay, given current events.
Well, true, but I was specifically talking about alternate Marvel universes, and more specifically, Mutant X.
Isn't that the universe where Storm's a vampire and Havok leads the X-Men?
Yes and no, respectively. Havok leads the Six, which has a significant overlap in membership. Magneto leads the X-Men, also. They live on the moon sometimes. The X-Men, not the Six. The Six live in a castle.
How did Alex get out of that universe anyway? I know he woke up in a coma back on Earth afterward, but that's really all.
Okay, so Captain America's hidden programming kicked in during a fight, and his mutant powers spiraled out of control.
Wait, Steve Rogers is a mutant?
No, Captain America of Earth 1298, who is never definitively established as Steve Rogers, is a mutant.
Sure, why not?
Anyway, Havok had to kill him, but their fight woke up the Beyonder, who was sleeping in the Earth's core.
The Beyonder?
Well, the goblin force inhabiting the husk of the Beyonder, but in terms of powers, the difference is really academic. Anyway, he went generally berserk and killed most of the heroes, but he was having trouble tracking down the X-Men, so he had to team up with...
Caliban? Boom Boom?
Dracula.
What?!
I'm Jay Edidin.
And I'm Miles Stokes.
And we are here to explain the X-Men.
Because it's about time someone did.
Welcome to episode 296 of Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men, where we walk you through the ins, the outs, and the retcons of comics' greatest superhero soap opera. And welcome to what's leading into the final stretch of our coverage of the X-Men's greatest dark alternate universe, the Age of Apocalypse.
That said, just like it's always Inferno, it's also always the Age of Apocalypse, and we're going to be seeing fallout from this storyline for basically ever.
Yeah, but it goes back to being, or goes on to be, just, you know, another parallel universe, not the storyline that just keeps going.
I don't know. I'm pretty sure Dark Beast is never going away.
Yeah, but that's not continuation of Age of Apocalypse. That's him moving over into other storylines. Anyway, it can't stay Age of Apocalypse forever. It's always already Inferno.
There is that. I guess it could be both. But speaking of moving into stories, we're moving into a story that actually has the words X-Men in the title. Once again, it's been a while. We did Astonishing X-Men as one of our earlier Age of Apocalypse episodes, and today we're talking about Amazing X-Men. Astonishing X-Men was the equivalent of Uncanny X-Men, and Amazing X-Men is the equivalent of Adjectiveless X-Men.
Or at least the parallel title to it. The idea that they're equivalents is one that rubs me a little bit wrong. Although they did set, as we've discussed, The Age of Apocalypse has a book that parallels every X title that was ongoing before it. I think it does them a disservice to say that they're just equivalents.
Yeah, I mean, the main way I think they're equivalent is that they have similar creative teams to the other books that sort of kind of correspond to them.
That's a good point. Can we go with corresponding, actually? I think corresponding title works a little bit better for me. I realize that that's really, really pedantic, but it clicks for me in ways that equivalent doesn't.
That works for me, and this podcast is no stranger to pedantry.
It's good to be precise about these kinds of things.
Right. Well, let's be precise, if very brief, about what got us to this point in Age of Apocalypse plot history.
Welcome back to the Age of Apocalypse, the alternate timeline created when Professor Charles Xavier, original founder of the X-Men, was accidentally killed by his time-traveling son Legion back in the 1970s before Xavier could go on to found the X-Men.
In this replacement world, the survival of the fittest obsessed villain Apocalypse has taken over much of the planet and turned it into a mutant supremacist hellscape, divided up among his four horsemen.
While Xavier may never have had a chance to found the X-Men, his friend Magneto did so in his honor just a bit later.
They fight back against all the genocide and whatnot.
Unlike Charles Xavier, who traditionally separated family from work, compassion, and the rest of his life, Magneto has welcomed his remaining relatives into the X-Men, meaning that at this point the team includes, or at least is tangential to, his surviving sons, Quicksilver, and the much, much younger Charles, and Charles's mother, Magneto's wife, Rogue.
Thanks to some very earnest rambling from the original timeline's only survivor, Lucas Bishop, Magneto has sent his various allies on various missions to try to fix the past and restore the significantly less apocalyptic timeline of Earth-616, the main Marvel Universe.
But as all of us living currently know, just because you're dealing with a crisis doesn't mean that you don't have to do your day job as well. And so there are still humans to protect and horsemen to fight. And that's what the rest of the X-Men are busy doing.
So, it might seem kind of weird that we're doing Amazing X-Men so much later than Astonishing X-Men, the other core X-book.
Doesn't seem weird to me. I mean, this book is building on and cross-referencing more and more and more events from other titles, which now we've already covered and folks are familiar with.
Exactly. And what's more, Amazing X-Men ends with a cliffhanger, or at least a transition page, that leads directly into the climax of the Age of Apocalypse, X-Men Omega. I think of Amazing X-Men as the sort of connective tissue book of the Age of Apocalypse. It just ties everything together, and I think it suffers a little bit as a result in terms of its own identity, its own memorability, but Fabian Nicieza has always been really, really good at doing the sort of unsung hero work of continuity, and he totally does so here.
What this title feels like to me more than anything else, more than any other book in the Age of Apocalypse, is getting dropped in for four issues of an ongoing run.
I completely agree, yeah. And in fact, the four issues we get here, they're not just one big plot the way they are for a lot of the other books. Like, issues one and two are one little plot that ties into a bunch of other stuff. Issues three and four are another.
And the plots that center this team aren't the big cataclysmic apocalyptic ones. They're things that are, for the most part, going on in the background or reacting to the books where the big wheels are actually turning.
Yeah, you know, they're doing the rest of the X-Men's laundry. They're taking care of all the dishes that Generation Next is leaving around.
Miles, Generation Next is dead.
Well, right. That's why they left all their dishes out. They were going to put them away, but then Colossus got them killed.
Ah, that makes sense. Now, ironically, My first quibble with this is basically exactly the situation we described. It's a perfectly adequate title, but I do feel kind of strongly that amazing is a bit of an overstatement.
Well, Marvel really liked the title because we actually, many years later, will get an Amazing X-Men Volume 2. That'll be an ongoing series, or as much as series were ever ongoing after 2000, full of a bunch of glorious stories. That's the one that opens with the ghost of Nightcrawler buckling swashes in heaven, fighting his demon pirate dad.
See, that's roughly what I expect from a book that titles itself Amazing.
Right, and that's the one with World War Wendigo, where the Avengers have to chase all the Wendigos out of Canada into the United States so the Canadian magic stops making them be Wendigo people.
The world is very silly.
It totally is. This series, however, is a little bit less so, as much as its villain Abyss would like to make it more so.
With that, let's dive into Amazing X-Men number 1, The Crossing Guards, written by Fabian Nicieza, penciled by Andy Kubert, inked by Matt Ryan, colored by Kevin Somers, with separations by Digital Chameleon, and oh my gosh, we are actually going to have, again, the same credits for every issue. That's the great thing about miniseries, man.
I mean, depending on the miniseries, we've definitely seen some miniseries within AOA even that switch pencilers halfway through.
Well, and there are other strengths. Okay, that's one of the great things about some miniseries.
Talking about credits, though, so we've been crediting, like, Digital Chameleon and the other similarly named separations company that I don't remember the name of right now for a while, and I realized I don't actually know what separations are in terms of comic book creation.
So the other company you were thinking of is, I believe, Electric Crayon, and color separation is where you break down original full color files into CM, Y, and K files so that then they can then be process printed.
Yeah, so there you go. Now, as for whether we should keep crediting them when we read off credits, I have no idea. And those companies are credited kind of inconsistently. Sometimes they're credited with separations, other times they're credited as co-colorists, so I don't know.
So it's an interesting question, and I was kind of wondering why you had suddenly started putting them in the credits, but I just sort of ran with it because I figured it was an important personal point to you. Generally, first of all, this is largely not work that's directly relevant to comics printing right now, but largely it gets credited as art tech or art assist or something like that these days. And it's, I think, for the most part done in-house. But yeah, I mean, I'm cool either way. It seems weird that we credit them and not letterers. We should have been crediting letterers since way back, because God knows I complain about them enough.
All right, let's go and edit all of our past episodes. We'll make it happen. But first, let's talk about this story. Let's talk about Amazing X-Men number one.
So this story opens in Booth Bay Harbor, Maine. This is where humans are massing for the Great Sentinel Airlift. Now, we've seen the other side of that airlift in Weapon X. This is the origin point. And among the crowd is, again, someone else we're going to see in Weapon X number two, and that is the disguised copycat. She's with the Brotherhood of Mutants and or the Brotherhood of Chaos. Its name is interchangeably those two. And this is a group that acts as enforcers for the Madri. They're basically the muscle end of this, the cult of warrior priests who are all Madrox dupes. I'm not even going to list them off, because except for Copycat and Box, Madison Jeffries, who die in Weapon X number two, all of these guys are going to be dead next issue. And most of them are really, really throwaway characters.
And to remind everyone, the Great Airlift is something that the Human High Council in human-controlled Europe is initiating to basically get as many humans as they can out of North America before they nuke North America.
So that's not great. I mean, the getting humans out is great. The nuking is dubious. Now, the X-Men, meanwhile, are practicing to facilitate the human exodus, although they are facing some very specific problems, namely, the Great Human Airlift is going to be executed by Sentinels. And Sentinels aren't programmed to recognize the X-Men as the good guys and on the side of humanity. They just target all mutants. So the X-Men are in a singularly precarious position, even for the X-Men.
And that's what gets us our Danger Room Open equivalent, as we so often get in X-Men stories in general and Age of Apocalypse stories in particular, as we watch this particular squad of X-Men go through a simulation of fighting a Sentinel and having Quicksilver run up and shove a CD-ROM into its CD-ROM drive to convince it that they're okay.
Isn't that how the Tomb Raider live-action movie started?
I don't know. Never seen it. But if it has Sentinels, maybe I should.
I saw it. Are you sure we didn't see it together?
Maybe I blocked it out.
It was, I mean, that's one of the only bits of it that I actually remember. It was pretty dull.
Well, anyway, this X-Men team isn't dull. Who's on it?
Okay. Our field leader at the moment is Quicksilver. And rounding out the team, we've got Storm, Iceman, Banshee, who, as in Giant Size X-Men number one, has come out of retirement to assist the team. We've also got Dazzler, and one teammate who really, really sticks out to me as an odd fit, and that is Exodus. Who is Exodus? What's his deal? I know we've seen him briefly in the main universe, but maybe we can remind folks about him again, because he's got a lot going on.
Well, Exodus was one of the translations of the villain of Final Fantasy V, who was also called X-Death. Oh, you mean Exodus in the Marvel Universe. Yeah, so Exodus is Magneto's herald. He was sort of the voice of Magneto when Magneto was comatose after getting his mind ripped out by Xavier. He's the leader of the Acolytes. He's an incredibly powerful telekinetic and a great big jerk who almost destroyed Genosha in the main universe.
He is the lawful evil to Fabian Cortez's chaotic evil.
That's a really good way of putting it, yeah. Now, here, in Age of Apocalypse, he's just sort of a normal dude with a ponytail and very powerful telekinesis. He was rescued by Magneto from one of the many apocalyptic experimentation areas, and now he's very grateful and is one of the X-Men.
He is kind of worshipful of Magneto. Also, I would question his just looks like a normal guy. He definitely has some weird computer headgear.
Well, right, but it's the Age of Apocalypse. Like, the guy that delivers your pizza probably has weird computer headgear.
I would say, in fact, that the guy who delivers your pizza is more likely to have weird computer headgear than an X-Man.
Probably true. Now, given that in the 616, it'll later be revealed that Exodus has a stupidly complicated, ridiculously convoluted backstory that stretches back, like, hundreds and hundreds of years, his backstory in the Age of Apocalypse doesn't really correspond, but you know what? Let's just not worry about it.
Yeah, One thing I like about this Exodus, you say he's just a regular guy, is that he is refreshingly simple.
Right?
Yeah, he may have that backstory, but it's irrelevant. It doesn't matter. All that matters is that he loves Magneto. And I guess also Dazzler.
Yeah, Exodus and Dazzler are dating. I do actually really appreciate that in the Age of Apocalypse, random characters who you wouldn't normally see together are hooking up, mostly just like opportunistically.
Now, I buy Exodus and Dazzler dating. What I don't buy that Dazzler is into in the Age of Apocalypse is cigarettes, because I feel like she is way, way, way too wed to her identity as a vocalist to smoke.
Well, yeah, and I remember her yelling at Logan about smoking like a whole bunch back in the day.
Well, I mean, so did Kitty Pryde, and she smokes here, but for Dazzler, I think it's a different situation just because specifically she is a singer.
Maybe she's a big Tom Waits fan and wants to sound like him.
Oh, she's going to have to do a lot more than smoke to that. I mean, that's some, like, gargling broken glass level.
Yeah. Talking about Dazzler, though, I find Dazzler fascinating in this. Like, she doesn't do a lot, but we find out that this big danger room fight against this sentinel that's just smashing everything in sight, that is entirely a hard light projection that she's using her powers to create. She can basically simulate, like, whatever the fuck she wants at whatever scale she wants using her powers, which is such an upgrade over what she can do in the main universe.
One of the things we see consistently in this universe is X-Men heroes and villains, actually, who are significantly more powerful, or at least who have explored and stretched the limits of their powers much further. And I think that's sort of a desperate times, desperate measures situation, that things that took characters in the normal universe much, much longer to grow into, to get comfortable with, to learn to use, the characters in this universe have basically been forced to do or die.
Yeah, I mean, later on, we find out that Iceman can teleport people using something called moisture molecular inversion.
I question the scientific validity of that. What he can do that interests me in here is reconstitute himself from vapor, which is something that really brought me to a bit in the Iceman series that Cena Grace wrote, where he talks about what it takes for him to turn into vapor. And what it means if this Iceman is so practiced with that he can reconstitute himself when he's vaporized by an enemy. But we are getting ahead of ourselves, because I want to spend some time on this team's field leader, who is, you know, I said Exodus was an unlikely fit, but in some ways, Quicksilver is an even weirder one, not only as a member of the X-Men, that's not weird, but as its leader and as a really good leader.
I know, because normally if you have the phrase team player and the name Quicksilver, like, they repel each other like magnets. They just don't work together. Quicksilver just hates everybody, especially his dad Magneto. Well, his sometimes dad Magneto.
Well, as we've discussed to some extent, this is a universe where Magneto has been at least a less shitty dad. And where his partnership with Wanda and Pietro seems to have been based much, much less on, you know, mutual debt and a lot of lies than on commonality of goals and family relationships.
Yeah, that's very true. They get along super well. And we saw in X-Men Chronicles number 1 that Magneto's other older child, Wanda, the Scarlet Witch, same thing. They were a really tight, really functional family.
And we've also seen that this is a Pietro who is much, much better rounded as a character, I think. His 616 equivalent is not someone who really gets along with anybody, let alone has, you know, really solid leadership skills as this one does. And I think a lot of that is that this is a Pietro who spent significant amounts of time with people whom he can absolutely trust.
Yeah, completely. And so he actually comes off resembling a very different 616 character than Pietro Maximoff.
Yeah, this Quicksilver has a lot in common with, I think, Cyclops at Cyclops' best. As a leader, he's exacting but harder on himself than anyone else. He's got a rigid, innate sense of right and wrong and a massive soft spot for kids. Bishop actually even comments on that at some point.
Yeah, well, and there's also the not exactly worshipful, but extremely respectful relationship he has with his boss. You know, Cyclops was that way with Xavier, and Quicksilver's that way with Magneto.
So I actually don't think that's equivalent, because I think Quicksilver and Magneto have a much, much healthier relationship.
That's probably true. Xavier's not the best father figure, especially towards Cyclops.
Well, and Quicksilver respects Magneto as a leader, but also very much directly has a familial relationship with him that's casual and genuine and affectionate. And while you see some of that with Cyclops and Xavier, it's really not what this is. And this is also, I'm not going to go into the details later, but there are points where I think there's a decision that Quicksilver makes and is able to make the way he does, honestly, because of the strength of his relationship with Magneto, that I think would be much, much worse for Cyclops relative to Xavier. I think they'd come to the same point, but I don't think it would be the same process, and I don't think it would necessarily have the same fallout.
Yeah, that, I know what you're talking about, and that may be true. We'll get to that. So what's going on with the X-Men? What's going on with their mission and the reasoning behind it?
Well, as we'd mentioned, Magneto has split the team. And as Dazzler points out, if any one group doesn't succeed, none of what the rest of them do matters. Magneto shows up in time to give a pep talk.
Allison, a wise man once said, "It ain't over till it's over."
So that line genuinely cracked me up when I read it because I was expecting it to be a Charles Xavier reference. No.
Exodus has kind of a good point, though, because he realizes that what the X-Men themselves are doing has nothing to do with fixing reality. They're just trying to, like, help folks out in this existing dystopian status quo.
Which, if things go well, will cease to exist. Yeah, I think that's kind of fundamental to the X-Men. You do it anyway, because it's the right thing to do.
I completely agree, yeah. So they need to go get to Maine to help with this great human airlift. Iceman has that teleportation thing, but apparently it's extremely uncomfortable, which I totally believe, because moisture molecular inversion?
Fortunately, Magneto's got another option. He's going to convince Exodus to believe in himself so hard that he learns to teleport on the spot. And he does.
It's just like when Sunspot taught himself to fly through sheer force of will, or when Magneto taught Lila Cheney to teleport, which she didn't think she could do, also through sheer force of will, kind of.
First of all, that was Super Doctor Astronaut Peter Corbeau. Second, it was not through sheer force of will, it involved a Virtual Boy.
Well, there's that.
I gotta say, though, Magneto's rationalization for why Exodus is just now learning to teleport, or he's just now telling Exodus that he can if he believes himself, is very Charles Xavier.
For years, I tried to prevent Exodus from using his powers to their fullest, for fear he might become as corrupted as those we oppose.
That's a bullshit rationalization. That is some Harrison Bergeron bullshit.
So they head out to Maine, and Storm flies up in the sky and uses her electricity to take out Apocalypse's defense monitoring tower, which lets the Sentinels finish the job and destroy it and get themselves through to pick up the humans.
Unfortunately, what they arrive in Maine to find is that the Brotherhood is waiting, and the Sentinels are fine with that because among the Brotherhood is Madison Jeffries, Box, who can talk to machines and has hacked the Sentinels such that they recognize the Brotherhood as friends and the X-Men as enemies. Not only that, but the cool bad boy of Apocalypse's horseman, it's not cool, Abyss, has shown up and kidnapped a kid for no apparent reason.
Oh man, this fucking guy. We'll get to him in a sec, but before we do, I do want to point out how cool it is that we see the X-Men doing one half of helping the humans get the airlift through. Like, they're taking out the Apocalypse border patrol right near North America, and we see Logan and Jean do the same equivalent thing with Europe and Weapon X. It's kind of fun.
I want to see the human side, and I really want to have it be like that episode of Community where you finally find out what the other students think of the study group.
Oh God, everybody is just totally infuriated by the X-Men.
Who have in fact ruined everything. What happened? They lost a pen.
Yup. So that takes us to Amazing X-Men number 2, Sacrificial Lambs. Like you said, same creative team. And we see where that kid ran off to, and we see Abyss in full for the first time. Also, the kid gets a name, which is Jeremy Graves. And if I've learned one thing from my years of reading X-Men, is that if you're not a main character, but you do get a name, it is not going to go well for you.
He'll be fine, because the thing is, we also see Abyss in full, and as far as I can tell, he's really just made of electrical tape.
Yeah, he's like this purple dude, but his body is made entirely of spiraled purple ribbons. You know, just like the ribbons that made up the early Phalanx prototypes, just like the ribbons that Selene got turned into in Fitzroy's spooling machine. What the hell is it with ribbons of flesh in the freaking 90s?
I question whether flesh is an accurate description of what Abyss's body is made of. More relevantly, do you think a lot of kids grew up with like an irrational, vague fear of electrical tape and springs and stuff?
Maybe, yeah. He is kind of like if a Slinky met a roll of tape. But he is a goofy, wacky guy. He's the one who, I mean, I always say that you should be your own best audience if you're a comedian or a podcaster, for instance. But I think Abyss maybe should learn to read the room, because he's just being wacky all the time and it just comes off as super annoying.
No, here's the thing that bugs me about Abyss. So he claims that he feeds on empty hope, but what he's wacky about is like, you're fucked. There's no hope. Everything's terrible. If he actually fed on empty hope, he should be basically a motivational speaker.
Oh, man. Yeah, that would be, well, maybe more enjoyable.
Like, he should be pouncing on kids in the woods to give them pep talks.
And then, you know, eating their hope. Okay.
Well, yeah. But no, instead we get him engendering the exact opposite, plus being really irritating about it.
Ah, now struggling won't get you anywhere. What good's it done you so far? Human cattle moo-moo, marching from all over, thinking you have the remotest chance in hell of salvation.
Oh, see, I imagined him talking kind of like Pee-wee Herman.
Now struggling, I can't even do a Pee-wee voice. I never realized I couldn't do a Pee-wee voice. I grew up on that show.
I'm sorry that I've forced you to come face-to-face with this terrible truth about yourself, Miles.
Well, speaking of face-to-face, he said, sadly segueing away.
Wait, is Strife here?
Oh, man, no, Strife's not here. But the X-Men are facing the Brotherhood of Roll 1d4 to see what they're the Brotherhood of.
Mutants and or Chaos. It's okay. It's a big fight. It's not really actually all that interesting. Copycat and Box are going to run off to Weapon X number 2.
One thing that is kind of cool is we see Banshee in combat for the first time, and you know how he normally has that big, stripy, floopy underarm cloak thing as part of his costume?
Yes.
Yeah, this time in the Age of Apocalypse, he just has these curved, 4-foot-long spikes sticking out from the underside of his arm. It's like those little spiky things Batman had if you made them way the fuck longer, and I don't know how that helps him fly, but it's pretty cool looking.
Oh, I thought they were like streamers. I didn't assume they were rigid.
I don't know. They look pretty rigid. At one point, he's doing a badass battle pose, and they're sticking straight out. Maybe they're just, you know, excited.
Maybe there's a breeze.
Two breezes? Because they're going in opposite directions.
Maybe he's moving his arms together very quickly.
I don't know. It's an alternate universe. Maybe Banshee does that. We know he's into some weird shit in the 616 with Moira, so who can say?
Comic books, man.
And Banshee thinks back to how Magneto got him to come out of retirement, despite the fact that he is clearly getting too old for this shit.
Spoiler, this is definitely Banshee's coming out of retirement for one last job series. He gonna die.
I need you back, Sean. Times are bad. We're going to lose this war. I know when you retired, you wanted time to yourself, but better to die on your feet than live on your knees.
I actually really enjoy the way Banshee sort of paraphrases Magneto's, like, overly self-serious speech.
I love the way when you were delivering that, you were waving your arms with, like, all of the awkward intensity of an OG Final Fantasy VII character.
Oh, yeah. No, you gotta. I mean, listeners, you may not be able to see us when we do quotes, but there's a lot of talking with our hands. At least there is for me.
More for Miles, I think.
Well, Banshee, while looking for the kid, does head back to the ship that the Brotherhood showed up in, and he finds the Madri, the Priests of Apocalypse, strung up, and also dead.
One of them, their leader. It really bothers me that Madri is the singular version of Madri. It should not be.
Should it be Madri, like cacti?
No, it should be Madrox. The singular of Madri should be Madrox.
Oh, well, anyway.
It turns out this is the work of Abyss, who is all too happy to explain at gratuitous length what he's up to.
Make them all paste, I say. The religious fanatic actually liked it, too. Thought he deserved it.
And who might you be?
You don't know? Fire my publicist! I'm the latest, greatest, the newest horseman of the apocalypse! Come on, Sean Cassidy, a big round of applause for the Abyss!
I realized I'm doing that voice like Mojo, but shittier.
You know who Abyss is?
Mojo, but shittier?
That too, but he's the guy who cosplays Joker and insists on staying in what he considers in character at conventions.
Oh man, that's even worse than your average Deadpool cosplayer.
At least he's doing the Mark Hamill one.
Oh, well, there's that, I suppose.
Or trying.
So Abyss opens up his, you know, ribbons and shows Sean that, hey, he's got a child all tied up inside there and demands the son of Magneto turn himself in exchange for this kid.
And to save the kid, Quicksilver runs into the obvious trap deliberately. He knows it's a trap, but he goes for it anyway. Again, I really like how black and white and straightforward this Quicksilver's ethics are. It fits him so well, especially this much less cynical version of him. He still makes snap judgments, it's just that now they're not about, you know, being judgmental. And he's also concerned, because he knows he's running into a trap, he doesn't want Storm, who tries to accompany him, to come with.
That is a sweet but ridiculous statement in light of who we are and what we do, my friend. You need someone with a clear head to back you. I know how you get when children are involved, but you know your father's cardinal rule. Never face an unknown enemy alone.
She also thinks to herself at this point about how long she waited to be human. And one of the things I really like about this series and this team, because it comes up with Quicksilver too, is that these X-Men, these mutants, very much think of themselves as humans. They don't think of themselves as separate or as something else. Like, they talk about having humanity.
And that brings me right back to Storm's journey in the 616, specifically when she had to sort of learn to be human rather than, you know, a goddess, which is how she saw herself, after she lost her powers and started to kind of recuperate in life death.
Yeah, but it also grounds these X-Men back in the idea that mutants are human, that whatever they are evolutionarily, whatever offshoot they are, which, first of all, they are, in fact, a subset of humans, and I will argue this at length, but that's not really the point here, that being a mutant is one of a fairly large number of ways to be human in the worlds that they usually occupy.
Yeah, it's an interesting take in this very, very different world, agreed. So they do, in fact, save the kid from Abyss. Basically, Quicksilver snaps, and as near as I can tell, just starts grabbing handfuls of Abyss ribbons and, like, shoving them into the void in Abyss's center. And so Abyss sort of goes inside out and disappears. And it kind of reminds me, do you remember the vacuum beast from the Beatles' Yellow Submarine cartoon movie in the Sea of Monsters that was sucking everything up, and then it saw its own tail and sucked that up, and then there was just nothing because it had taken itself out?
So vividly that I am watching that sequence in my mind as you describe it. I also just realized what specifically Abyss reminds me of, which is unspooling VHS tape.
Oh, yeah, he totally looks like that. You're absolutely right. The way the different streams kind of spiral around each other, but irregularly, and they don't ever look like they're holding their shape.
I also realized, based on the combination of that and his demeanor, what he should be, which is the mascot of a VHS rental place who reminds you to rewind the tapes.
Oh, man. I mean, he'd be a little terrifying as that, but I don't know. I used to work at a Blockbuster and nobody ever rewound, so maybe they needed a little fear to, you know, make sure they did it.
I mean, he'd be awful, but his dialogue is perfectly in keeping with, like, mid-90s mascots.
Pretty much. Now, as Storm teases Quicksilver for finally giving into his emotions and having that accomplish something, the rest of the X-Men have been busy too. They have reprogrammed the Sentinels to make the Sentinels' first priority protecting humans, which supersedes their existing priority of killing mutants. And so the Sentinels are like, okay, fine, we'll work with these mutants to help humans, damn it.
Now, we know from various days of futures past that that would probably backfire as a long-term strategy, but this universe is presumably not long for the multiverse, so we'll let it pass here.
Meanwhile, Apocalypse is off doing his own thing, having briefly gotten off of his flaming skull sauna platform to interrogate Angel's captured employee, Karma, to figure out where the X-Men are hiding so he can go take out their headquarters and capture their leader.
And to get that information with her, they threaten her with a character who may or may not be one we're familiar with. Who is the Shadow Thief? Is this just the Shadow King?
This is just the Shadow King. We've seen in the Excalibur series, X-Calibra, that the Shadow King works for Apocalypse. He's a psychic entity that does terrible, terrible things. Interestingly, he's called, like you said, the Shadow Thief. And one of our listeners pointed out that that's probably because Apocalypse doesn't want anybody to call themselves a king around him. That said, Nicieza will totally refer to this entity as the Shadow King later in the series when he forgets, but still.
Can I confess something?
Please.
Because of the order I read these in, and because of my absolute unfamiliarity with the characters, and because of their mutual general cartoonishness in the series, I thought Abyss and the Shadow King were the same character.
Oh, man. Oh, that is perhaps a failure of storytelling, because the Shadow King's a great villain and Abyss is a terrible one.
Yeah, it seemed a little inconsistent to me, too. But, you know, what did I know? I didn't know this universe.
This was where you started. One creepy thing, though, is seeing how terrified Karma is of the Shadow King slash Thief, because remember in New Mutants when he possessed her for a really, really long time and made her do terrible things to people? And there was a really strange body size subplot related to that that was creepy, whether or not it was well executed.
Yeah, that got aggressively fatphobic.
It did, but I can see Karma being terrified of him even across universes.
Now, as we venture across universes, we come to Amazing X-Men number 3, Parents of the Atom. I dig the title. With, again, the same creative team. And it opens, one of the things I love about Fabian Nicieza as a writer is that he understands Magneto drama and he loves it and he leans into it, which is why we get an issue that opens with Magneto in full cape, and his cape is really capey in this series, soliloquizing at Xavier's grave in the rain, just for that maximum drama level. Unfortunately, he doesn't get to finish soliloquizing because Infinite's attack, but still, you gotta give the guy style points.
Oh, hell yeah.
And speaking of delightful Nicieza Magneto, there is a really great bit of Silver Age Magneto that slips through when the Infinite's means of conveyance shows up.
Vanisher, it has been a long, long time since last we clashed.
Who the hell talks like that? I love it.
Yeah, I mean, Magneto does. His outfit may be red, but its highlights and his pros are purple.
Now, Magneto and Bishop could handle a handful of Infinites handily. Less so their boss's boss's boss, Apocalypse.
And Apocalypse shows up and just kicks the crap out of both of them. I do appreciate that he makes his arm really, really big. So big that the panel that this scene takes place in is like extra, extra tall, just so he can pound Bishop literally into the ground. Do you ever think it's weird that Apocalypse and Kamala Khan, like the current Ms. Marvel, have almost identical powers in some ways?
I mean, so does Reed Richards, if you're going to actually go in that direction.
I guess that's true. And they can hang out with Plastic Man and the Elongated Man and just be really stretchy and get all tangled up.
Ew.
Yeah, maybe they shouldn't. Good point. So Magneto decides, you know what? I have the big bad here. All of my friends and family almost are safely clear. I am just going to blow us all up. I'm going to kill myself and kill Apocalypse in one go.
And he can do this because he has Bishop's plasma gun, which he has allowed Bishop to keep for self-defense, and which Bishop has thus far mostly brandished around to make points. Apocalypse calls his bluff, and he does it exquisitely.
Are you so certain of that, X-Man? Show me you have the courage to do this. If this gamble fails, if I survive and you don't, then tell me, what will become of your beloved son, Charles? The child whom my loyal Infinite, the Vanisher, is retrieving even as we speak, from your secret tunnels beneath these grounds.
This is another Magneto versus Xavier question. Do you think Xavier would have pulled the pin?
I think he would have, actually. Yeah, I do think he would have. I think, yeah, this Magneto is one who cares so deeply about his family and one who lets himself be so human because of how deeply he cares. And Xavier, he was always tight with, you know, the X-Men, certainly, and he has a biological son, but he always saw himself as a set of ideals more than a person.
Yeah, and that's the biggest difference in this Magneto, I think, because 616 Magneto cared at this point. Well, okay, it was catatonic, but in the surrounding years, 616 Magneto in general, as a general character, cares deeply about things, but what he tends to care deeply about, what he invests in, is principles or the appearance of principles and the means to achieve them. And this is a Magneto who cares about not only people as an overarching group, but individuals, which is not really something you see. You see 616 Magneto caring a lot about individuals because they're mutants, but not so far beyond that for the most part. That's something that he's really kind of deliberately excised from himself, and not so much this Magneto, which Apocalypse again keys right in on.
And that is why I shall always triumph over your kind.
Because good is dumb.
Because one life, or a billion, it matters not to me. And once I had such hopes for you, Magneto.
Sorry, whenever there's a why I will always triumph speech, I kind of go back to Spaceballs.
Oh, I was totally doing the same thing.
So, underground, as she flees with the kid, Nanny will kill the Vanisher, only to be taken out by Strong Guy and Gambit and the Externals number 4.
I really appreciate that Nanny is just on her little wheeled feet going from one miniseries to the next with baby Charles.
See, you make it sound so cute. She's covered in guns, man.
Oh, she is. But as she pulls out like 10 freaking guns out of her various robot parts, I really do love baby Charles's sort of gee whiz grin that he has inside of the safety bubble in her chest.
Okay, Age of Apocalypse miniseries, and it's Lone Wolf and Cub, except it's Nanny and Charles.
I love everything about this. It's like if Lone Wolf was the baby cart. Anyway, the team gets back, they find evidence of the fight, and they manage to figure out pretty accurately what went down.
Now, Quicksilver decides to take a cue from his father and split the team even further. Exodus and Dazzler head off to Gambit and the Externals number 4, and Iceman goes over to Astonishing X-Men number 4. Quicksilver, meanwhile, heads off to see the one guy who might be able to give them the information they need. And I gotta say, one of the things I really appreciate about the Age of Apocalypse in general is that pretty much everyone working in it recognizes just how punchable Age of Apocalypse Warren Kenneth Worthington III is. So punchable.
Seriously. Freaking everybody shakes down Angel for information. He's like freaking Turk from Daredevil.
There's a line, I can't remember whether it's, I think it's Wonder Woman might, in Justice League Unlimited, you say, you ever get chafed straddling that fence all the time, which I really wish someone had said to him. But man, Quicksilver's subsequent burn is also really solid. Must be nice, Worthington, to have running water. The better to rinse your hands clean of the blood.
And Quicksilver, like everybody does from Angel, totally gets his information.
Yeah, again, I do really appreciate when people call out this Angel's complicity, that his vaunted neutrality is, in a lot of ways, tantamount to collaboration.
Because if you choose not to decide, you still have made a choice. Which I liked that line a lot better before I realized how objectivist Rush was as a band, but eh, what can you do?
I like that you said it in a Yoda voice.
You know, Yoda, best bassist ever.
Wow, that was like a stack of deep cuts. You are down to the bone at this point. Now, anyway, back in the Age of Apocalypse, Magneto's at the Citadel. He's prisoner there, but Bishop is being held in Quebec at the Tabernacle of the Madri, who are Quebecois, I guess, or at least based there.
Huh, I mean, they separate from their prime Madrox, so maybe they're separatists. It would make sense.
Dubious. Now, The team is not going to be able to rescue both of them. They could split up, but they would not be able to take down either force with the team split. And also, it's questionable whether they'd be able to get into the Citadel anyway. So Quicksilver ultimately makes the impossible choice. They're going to get Bishop. And later, Storm calls him on not going after Magneto or baby Charles. And it turns out, basically, what the explanation we get is that Quicksilver is, in fact, a really fucking good leader.
Pietro, please don't shut me out. I know how much this is hurting you, to abandon your brother as well as your father.
It is the logical decision, Aurora.
Logic? You nearly sacrificed the evacuation yesterday to save one child, and now you turn your feelings off when it comes to your own family.
I can't, I won't even allow myself to think about it, Aurora. I've already lost so much fighting this endless war. My sister, my life, everything. And although I want to save my brother, I have faith that Dazzler and Exodus will do all they can to rescue Charles while I am needed here.
Valid fucking point, Pietro.
Yeah, he's very, very good. Now, meanwhile in Quebec, the Shadow King is running around Bishop's head, being baffled and horrified, and finally ejected.
I do really appreciate that when he sees Bishop's memories of Xavier, he's like, oh yeah, that guy. We had a fight in Egypt that one time. I remember that. Because, of course, that was one of the few events in the X-Universe that took place before Xavier was assassinated.
Based on what the Shadow King is able to get out of Bishop's head, Abyss concludes that they gotta kill him, Bishop, to make sure the world he imagines never, ever, ever comes to pass. But the best part of the issue is the closing narration.
As the X-Men head off to almost certain doom.
They leave in silence to save a man they barely know and salvage a plan they can scarcely understand. For in this age of apocalypse, that is what it means to be X-Men. Narrator, that is a fairly on-the-nose description of what it means to be X-Men in most universes.
Yeah, it sucks to be an X-Man.
Well, and it's really confusing most of the time, too.
And it sucks to be an X-Man, and it's confusing to be an X-Man also in Amazing X-Men number 4 on Consecrated Ground. Again, same creative team. So the Madri are hanging out with the strung-up in weird techno-shibari Lucas Bishop, and they're talking in that chant font we mentioned, so presumably in some kind of a Gregorian chant, about not letting his blasphemy fuck up the timeline. And apparently the way they're going to kill him is by cutting him, dripping his blood into a fancy chalice, drinking that, and then pouring it back into him.
I'm not sure if that's how they're going to kill him. I think that's just how they're going to do some kind of ritual purification. It is also an important stage that they chant at the chalice at one point.
They do. Like, what the fuck, you guys? Is their favorite movie The Craft and they took it way too seriously?
So, we know Apocalypse set everything up in this world. Who do you think, like, wrote all the rules and rituals for the Madri? And was it an elaborate practical joke taken too far?
I think it might have been the trolls from that one Art Adams X-Factor story, because they be trolling. I appreciate that disapproving shake of your head, Jay.
Anyway, Storm gets in time to keep them from killing Bishop. She freezes the dripping blood for dramatic effect and then literally blows away the Madri and then gets Bishop out with a set of lockpicks and then implies that the only place one can learn to use lockpicks is as a child on the streets of Cairo, which I am fairly sure is not the case.
Yeah, I mean, did Jill Valentine, the master of unlocking, have to go to Cairo to figure that out?
Yes.
I found out recently that in the Resident Evil novelizations, they expand the background of a lot of the characters, and apparently Jill's dad is a master thief named Dick Valentine, which, perhaps coincidentally, perhaps not, is the name of the lead singer of the band Electric Six.
Okay, first of all, that's a terrible name. Second, it would have been so much cooler if it was just like, yeah, my dad was a locksmith and I grew up messing around with locks all the time.
Nope, master thief named Dick Valentine.
Why everything gotta be drama?
Why everything gotta be Dick Valentine?
No.
So Quicksilver and Banshee sneak in as this is all going on, and they find the original Prime Jamie Madrox, who is filthy and drooling in a pile of baby toys and begging for death.
Yeah, so Dark Beast has screwed with his powers and massively amplified him such that basically he can be the source for these legions of Madri.
The way he's depicted here reminds me a lot of the way that Jamie Braddock was depicted in the Captain Britain run that predates Excalibur, like wearing a t-shirt, a diaper slash loincloth slash underwear, being super out of it.
Yeah, but this is a Jamie Madrox who is aware to an extent of his situation and surroundings, and definitely aware of what he's been used to do.
Oh, yeah, he is just clearly in psychological and probably physical agony. Like, that's something that Hubert does really well. It is palpable just how much this guy is suffering.
What he actually reminds me of most is Rachel in the first Sandman story, John Constantine's ex-girlfriend, who's been living in the dream world.
Oh, God, yeah, I haven't thought about that in ages.
Yeah.
So Quicksilver and Banshee debate what to do with Madrox, because if they kill him, Madrox immediately tells them all of the Madri will die and Storm and Bishop are going to be okay. Weirdly, it's the very logical Quicksilver who can't handle the idea of killing Jamie, and Banshee is trying to convince Pietro to do it.
The reason for that is because when anyone says logical in this series, they mean tactical. Quicksilver is a very good tactician with, you know, really good reasoning, but we've seen him enough to know that he thinks with his heart when it comes to lives.
Yeah, and he very much does here. And so in this emotional scene, Abyss obviously has to come and fuck it up.
Yeah, he shows up initially to obnoxiously taunt them at exhaustive length. Which grows into a showdown with Banshee.
And take your friend, Banshee! Know what he's afraid of? He's terrified of dying and living and everything in between.
Show me a man with no fears, Abyss, and I'll show you a fool. Specifically, I'll show you Matt Murdock, who is, in fact, the embodiment of that word.
Didn't somebody do a tarot card of him as the fool at one point?
I don't know, but that sounds both awesome and, yeah, fairly appropriate.
I really love Banshee in this for the same reason that I really love him in X-Men. He's seen it all. He's a realist, and he's not afraid to admit that he's flawed and not let that slow him down.
He is also, as I said earlier, the cop who's come back for the one last job, and this is where he plays out the rest of that trope. He dives literally into Abyss and basically blows them both up by screaming real hard.
And shortly after that, just as Quicksilver is already depressed, Madrox Prime manages to will himself to die, which takes out all the other Madri.
Honestly, I think that's the only way they could have actually played that scene or ended it, because it was really, really clear that he was kind of beyond rescue at that point. I mean, he seemed to think himself beyond rescue. His powers had been stretched to the point that there was no other way to stop the Madri. And ultimately, it had to be, if it was going to happen, a choice that Jamie still made. Because, I mean, this was someone from whom all of his agency had been completely taken, who had been basically forcefully infantilized and also used to do this abominable stuff. And so this is kind of him claiming control one last time.
Yeah, I really appreciate that happens. It's like a much more intense version of Carol Danvers choosing the method of her death in that issue of Weapon X.
That was pretty intense, too.
True. So the X-Men, divided though they are, have succeeded in their mission. They've rescued Bishop, and they go back to the X-Mansion, or what's left of it after Apocalypse smashed it a lot, to reconvene. And this is the scene that takes us right into X-Men Omega, the end of the Age of Apocalypse. The Astonishing X-Men team blinks back in, because Iceman retrieved them in Astonishing X-Men number 4. I'd like to point out, Sunfire is the only member of the team who's not here. I bet he quit the team on the way back.
Oh my God, you're so right. He had his moment of catharsis. He grew into himself and he realized that, yeah, fuck this, and quit the team, because that's what Sunfire does at peak self-realization.
Exactly. And Colossus, Shadowcat, and Ilyana are here too from Generation Next. Oh man.
And Rogue, of course, asks what happened to the kids, to which Colossus responds,
"They didn't make it." Blink is horrified.
All of them? No, all of them. I should have been with them.
Cause yeah, in the 616, she would have been a member of Generation X, and so presumably she had at least some relationship with that team in this universe too.
And this is ironically the reversal of what happened there, where she survived and the rest of them are dead.
Nightcrawler and Destiny teleport in from, I don't know, off camera. So they're here too.
Now, all of these are the teams that achieved their goals. That leaves Gambit and the Externals, who fucked up.
Exodus and Dazzler come back with Gambit, Jubilee, and Lila. Lila, who has changed outfits yet again. I fully believe that she would totally change outfits between issues. And the next page opens with Gambit getting punched into the panel through a wall by a furious Rogue, because he let her kid go. He let her kid get taken by bad guys. And also, he's just Remy.
Yeah, he is. He is the second most punchable, not entirely villainous character in the Age of Apocalypse, after Warren. Sabretooth sums up the state of affairs.
Everybody did pretty much what they were supposed to. Except for LeBeau, big surprise. So what do we do now?
Quicksilver answers.
Now, Creed, we have to regain that piece of the Emkron crystal, rescue Magneto and my brother, and then we do what the X-Men have always done. We give our all, our lives, to make sure this is the day Apocalypse falls.
Okay, super badass, defiant X-Men splash page of all the team looking awesome that ends this series versus the equivalent that ends Astonishing X-Men. What's your favorite?
I like the end of the Excalibur graphic novel.
I mean, that's pretty great, too, if it's much happier from The Sword is Drawn, you mean, when they're all hugging?
Yeah.
Okay, you know, I'll accept it. So that's Amazing X-Men. It ties everything together really well. It's not about any one thing, but the Age of Apocalypse wouldn't be the Age of Apocalypse without it.
I still think the title isn't misnomer. It should be, you know, Industrious X-Men, maybe.
Effective X-Men.
Yeah. Coherent X-Men. So, every week that we cover the Age of Apocalypse, in addition to covering a specific story, we're stepping back and looking at some aspect of that universe as a whole. And this week's focus topic is kind of inspired by a question, which is, what's something central to the regular Marvel universe that's missing from the Age of Apocalypse?
A guy who's a skeleton and he's on fire and he rides a motorcycle?
I actually don't know if Ghost Rider is in AOA, is he?
I'm not sure either. Okay, well, in that case, how about going with the same theme, a team of motorcycle guys whose power it is to make another motorcycle guy?
Oh, Team America definitely exists in the Age of Apocalypse. I believe it in my heart. But actually, those are kind of subsets of the bigger thing that I'm thinking of, and that is superheroes.
You know, that's a really good point, because the X-Men are basically the only good guys, the only at least good guys that do more than be bureaucratic and betray people all the time. And they're not really exceptional in terms of what they do and how they do it power-wise in this world.
Well, there's also no social role equivalent to superheroes in this universe. And part of it, yeah, is that everyone is powered. Like, when we think of Marvel universes without superheroes, we usually think of ones that are parallel to our own, where, you know, no one's got any powers, for instance, or where something has happened and all of the superheroes are dead, but the concept still exists. What makes Age of Apocalypse interesting as an extension of the Marvel universe is that it's a universe that has no corresponding role to superheroes. It has no space for superheroes for a couple reasons. I mean, one of them is that none of them survived the rise of Apocalypse, or at least no one who was doing that did. I think there was the potential for the X-Men to become that. You saw them brightly colored earlier on, but that's really gone at this point. And even the X-Men, instead of being superheroes, are basically just, you know, they're the resistance. They're still symbols. They're still powerful, but they're not superheroes in the senses that we define them in the 616.
Yeah, in a way, in the earlier stories, I'm thinking like X-Men Chronicles number 2 and thereabouts, they're almost celebrities. They're almost figureheads. you know, people who exist to fight back against the bad guys, but also to provide an example of how one can fight back, of having the willpower and the strength to do so.
I mean, they're substantial resistance, but they're also the figureheads of that resistance. Yeah, Magneto is the Che Guevara of the Age of Apocalypse.
He'd look pretty good in that hat. I mean, would it be on top of his helmet or instead of his helmet? Or would he just make a helmet that looked like that hat?
Well, he's iconic in the same way, though, is what I'm saying. Like, he's again, a figure who is an actual person and who is effectively a folk hero and a significant political figure, but not a superhero.
That's really true, yeah. I mean, I think superheroes imply a better world. They are sort of windows into the ideal in a lot of ways. And this is a world where that's just been burned out and they can't be so lofty and so conceptual.
They also imply exceptional capabilities. And that's something that doesn't set anyone apart in this world. Whether or not mutants are the majority, they're what's established as the social status quo by the folks in power.
That's a really good point, yeah. And so, I don't know, in a way, I think that almost makes the X-Men more heroic. Like, we're used to them being hated and feared in the 616, but in this, they're just this team of rebels who are, you know, essentially fighting their own kind, fighting the system of privilege they could be part of, and continually losing more and more ground as they go. Like, for the same reason that I think the main characters of Angel are so admirable, and, well, some ways, in others they're terrible, the X-Men are here, you know? They know they're not going to win. They know they're going to have to sacrifice it all, and maybe it won't even accomplish anything, and they keep going.
Yeah, and I mean, I think this is part of why the X-Men have always been an odd fit for me as superheroes in the traditional sense. Like, that's a role they play sometimes, but it's very much a role that they play in context of a larger cause. And in this case, the universe around them fits that pretty well, too. Speaking of universes, we've got some questions from all of y'all. And the first one of those is about the multiverse. Alex Holt asks on Twitter, has the system of world designation numbers ever been given an origin in universe? Does the fact that the Age of Apocalypse is Earth 295 versus Earth 616 imply that whoever was naming them found AOA first or thought it was a more likely timeline?
Oh man, I love this question for two reasons. First reason is that I love organizing things, and when that overlaps with comic books, that's even better. And the second reason is that I get to talk about some glorious, glorious nonsense I very recently read. So, of course, most people assume that most of the parallel universes in Marvel are based on the month and year of their first appearance. So, like, Age of Apocalypse is Earth 295 for February 1995. That's based on an initially incorrect assumption that Earth 616 was because the Marvel Universe kinda sorta started in 1961, June 616. In reality, Alan Moore in an old Captain Britain story way back in the day just wanted a large-ish number for the main Marvel Universe to make it clear that it wasn't special, but he credits the writer Dave Thorpe, who predated him on Captain Britain, and Alan Davis, who worked around that era too, said that Thorpe wanted that number to be close to 666 as a jab at Marvel. Fun fact, by the way, I found out when I was researching this that the animated Silver Surfer universe from the Silver Surfer cartoon is Earth 936652, and if you dial 936652 on a touch-tone phone, it spells out Zen La, the name of the surfer's home planet. That's really fun. Anyway, all of that to say, as far as an in-universe explanation, yes, there is one. So toward the end of X-Man, the series that continued out of the Age of Apocalypse about Nate Gray, there was a publishing sort of mini line with an X-Men called Counter-X. That was where Warren Ellis took over X-Man, Generation X, and X-Force, and did his usual Warren Ellis-y thing of making them all high concept and bizarre. And in one of the X-Man stories within Counter-X, we find out that the universes are actually numbered on a continuum from chaos to order. The lowest numbers are more chaotic, the highest numbers are more orderly. And in this story, this angel-type dude from one of the highest universes, I think the highest known universe, decides he's going to destroy all the lower numbered universes to prevent them from corrupting his own universe. And what makes me really happy, I'm usually not happy about destroying worlds, but bear with me, is that he does in fact annihilate the lowest five worlds. And so for the rest of the story, the narration refers to Earth 616 as Earth 611 because the numbers all shifted downward. And this is never, ever mentioned again. Hooray. To contradict that, in the Edge of Spider-Verse story from not too long ago, we find out that Earth 001 is home to the Web of Life and Destiny, where divine arachnids maintain a map of the multiverse. I want to hang out with those spider gods. While we're at it, the highest numbered Earth I could find was Earth 287449230489932. Which was from the Avengers Time Runs Out story. So, the short version, yes, there is a justification in later X-Men, except that it's not exactly continuity because everybody just totally ignored that story. So there you go.
I always like to think that within the Marvel Universe, the universes are named every bit as arbitrarily as they are in our universe, and to an extent every bit as arbitrarily as, for example, new species or newly discovered stars are named in our universe.
Oh, so there's like one universe out there that's just named after Gary Larson because it's shaped like a Far Side character?
Well, they get numbers, but there's like a universe that's someone's kid's birthday and stuff.
Yeah, okay. There actually is a parallel universe in the multiverse that is based on the birthday of one of the people who created it. But anyway, Chris asks via email, with the Emkron crystal being the nexus of all realities, why isn't it referenced in other Marvel storylines that involve the multiverse?
So, Chris, there are a couple different answers to this question. The cynical answer is human error. The optimistic answer is that ultimately, the Marvel Universe's main function is as a vehicle for stories, and you choose the devices that best serve the story that you're telling, even if that means ignoring some things that were established previously. The accurate answer is probably a bit of each.
I mean, how many devils are there in the Marvel Universe? And, like, for a while, a lot of them were the actual single devil, until they started having devil parties in the Hell on Earth horror storyline in X-Factor anyway.
I mean, we're talking about a multiverse that has councils of Reed's Richards and Dracula's.
Oh, it totally does. We have a council of listeners, and they help us make the show by contributing. Certain levels of contribution come with on-air acknowledgement from various fictional characters and concepts. Today, we'll be hearing some solo words from the angry Claremontian narrator.
Look how far you have fallen, Evans Rostlick. Plunged from your pedestal, battered by the slippery slopes of your own hubris, and bereft of all that once defined you, you crawl through the depths of this dark night of your soul, too lost even to grope towards whatever faint light may filter this far down. At least you're not alone. Not alone in failure, nor even alone in the rock bottom along which you must now painfully drag yourself. Which brings us to Courtney, who, if anything, should be even more ashamed than you are, Evan. I mean, Courtney, look at you. It's one thing to brave the dark night of your own soul. It's another thing entirely to miss so badly that you land in the dark night of someone else's. Let alone Evan's Rostlick's. I mean, how embarrassing is that?
And with that,
Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men is recorded in New Fairfield, Connecticut, in exile from Forest Hills, New York, and in Portland, Oregon, and produced by Matt Hunter.
New episodes come out most Sundays on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and at explainthexmen.com.
Check out explainthexmen.com for all kinds of extra content, including visual companions to every episode.
Our show is 100% listener-supported. If you'd like to help us stay in the air and ad-free, check out the Patreon link at the top of explainthexmen.com.
Next week, we get to hang out with the theater kids of the Age of Apocalypse.
And rising star, Nathan Gray.
In the pages of X-Man.